From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. For an expectant mom, there is no thrill like that first ultrasound picture. There on the monitor in grainy black and white floats your baby. It may look a lot like E.T., but still, it's alive. Computer programmer Steve Grand may be the only man who knows just what that feels like. He still remembers the day he looked at his computer screen and realized he'd created the world's first artificial beings.
Soppy, dewy-eyed, awfully cute and sickly creatures who I have learned to hate over the last 10 years.
In this hour, bouncing baby Norns. Also, a new explanation of the birth of Jesus. And the Battle of the Bulge, the new science of pregnancy.
The baby's very much like a sort of invading parasite that sets up shop inside the woman's body. Within just a week or two of it appearing, it completely redirects her whole biology.
Coming up, things about pregnancy your mother didn't tell you. There's a lot about pregnancy and new motherhood that American women don't expect. In her new book, Misconceptions, feminist Naomi Wolf argues that for millions of women today, the experience of childbirth is a series of mostly unpleasant surprises. Wolf told Anne Strainchamps that her own first experience of pregnancy and childbirth stunned her.
We had our first child 6 years ago. I had what I have come to understand is an ordinary bad birth experience shared by millions of women across the country. I had a traumatic cesarean section, and I suffered for 6 months from postpartum depression. And I wouldn't say that I felt cheated by the experience. Rather, I felt like I was hit by a truck, and I noticed that many women around me also going through new motherhood seemed sometimes really shaken and sometimes really overwhelmed by the experience of childbirth and the adjustment to new motherhood. And
why do you say that a bad birth experience is common? Because I think the general sort of feeling these days is in some ways there's never been a better time to be a parent.
I'm sure there's never been a better time to be a parent, but are you saying the general feeling among women is there's never been a better time to give birth? Because, in fact, to my surprise, considering the birthing industry has been under attack by feminists for 25 years, things are in many ways worse than ever in terms of the agribusiness practices of ever more medicalized and ever more artificially speeded up labor and delivery experiences.
I guess I'm surprised because if you're pregnant and you go into the hospital and you look around, or if you just drive down the street and you see ads for hospitals on billboards, they all have these beautiful birthing suites that look like hotel rooms, and everybody takes Lamaze classes, and it seems like the whole emphasis is on, you know, really friendly, warm, comfortable kinds of birth experiences.
Well, I'm sorry to tell you that those ads represent a new kind of metamorphosis of the birthing industry with new kinds of marketing aimed at women like you and me who, you know, want to have a more holistic and less intrusive birth experience. But in fact, they are often window dressing on worse realities than, you know, than even 25 years ago. For example, those nice classes that you're talking about, often you will take a birth class and you'll be encouraged to learn little panting breaths, which turn out to be completely pointless in dealing with actual labor pain, and you'll be trained to, you know, deliver on your back or your side lying down with your husband, quote, coaching you or your partner coaching you. One example of something that's really shocking is that 90% of women in America give birth in a hospital and most of them lie down. Other countries that have much better outcomes for mothers and children consider this practice barbaric, and it is barbaric. When you lie down, you are laboring in the most physically excruciating position. Of course, you're going to call for an epidural right away, which leads to other outcomes like a higher rate of lacerations, more difficulty bonding with the baby, and so on. And the baby, when you're lying down, has to move up the birth canal against gravity, which also can cause arrested labor and other things that are more likely to lead to surgical birth.
The other thing you point out in your book, which certainly nobody ever told me in birthing class, is that if you have an epidural, your chances of winding up with a C-section instantly go way up.
Isn't that shocking? They also didn't tell me in birthing class, and you won't read this in What to Expect When You're Expecting, which really presents an epidural as a no-brainer. Like, would you rather have agonizing birth or the same birth with no pain. Duh. See what I'll, you know, what do you feel like? But in fact, every hour you're on an epidural, your chance of maternal fever goes up in the double digits. And the final example of this is midwives. Midwifery birth is much healthier than obstetrical birth, all the studies show. And more obstetricians are pairing up with midwives, ostensibly in a partnership, and What to Expect says this is the best kind of practice, best of both worlds. Do not be fooled. In many, many practices, the midwives basically are handmaidens to the obstetricians and literally don't have decision-making power. This is what happened to us. My midwives would have given me a very different trial of labor, but because they had not even the power to let me labor longer, even though they knew it was perfectly safe, hospital protocols kicked in and we were shunted along the assembly line of what was probably an unnecessary cesarean section. C-sections, one woman in four is going to have a cesarean section. Most think, as I did, oh my God, thank God my baby and I were saved from, you know, some horrible medical nightmare. In fact, according to the World Health Organization, only 6 to 12% of those are necessary. Three times as many C-sections are done as are necessary. What are the reasons?
The other thing is by now, I think we tend to know so many people who have C-sections for one reason or another. They've come to seem sort of common. I know women who have deliberately chosen C-sections and scheduled their birth, you know, and gone out to dinner the night before, knowing that at 7 a.m. the next day they were scheduled to give birth.
Yeah. And what shocks me is that their care providers supported them in that without telling them that cesarean section is major organ surgery with major risks that vaginal birth doesn't have, and that you're more likely to, again, have trouble because of the drugs, have trouble with nursing, have trouble with bonding the baby with the baby afterwards. And it's much more likely to lead to postpartum depression. I mean, basically, obstetricians love cesareans. And I'm not saying this to be critical of obstetricians. They are pushed on both sides. Hospitals love them because a hospital is a for-profit institution, and they've got to clear the floor. There's this constant pressure. You know, staff are asked, why is your patient still there? But the real reason so many cesareans are so popular among obstetricians is it protects them from lawsuits, that basically it's not safer to do these unnecessary cesarean sections, but they can tell a court of law that they did everything possible.
Your book is not just about the actual labor and delivery experience. You also comment that even after the birth of a child, and no matter how bad the birth was, underneath the joy of having the new baby, women experience a kind of inarticulate rage. You also write that women are grieving. What is the rage and the grieving about, do you think?
Well, I don't think all women experience rage and grief. I think, you know, some women sail through birth and new motherhood. But I do know that one woman in two in America does suffer from postpartum depression. That is grief, and it's real grief. I experienced it. Some of it is hormonal, but some of it is the way we expect new mothers to mother in our society. You know, you go home after one of these births, and if you're lucky, as I said, someone is with you for a few days after the birth, and then you're mostly alone. And no matter how thrilled you are to have a baby, it is overwhelming to be one pair of hands for a tiny dependent child. And I was really struck by the fact that, you know, in many cultures around the world, for the first 40 days after you give birth, you're really mothered as a new mother. You know, other women in the community come to your house and they feed you and they make sure you don't have to look after other children or do housework. They make sure that all you need to do is lie in bed if you want to and fall in love with that baby and nurse that baby. And those societies have almost no postpartum depression. Ours, in contrast, talks a good game about mothers and babies, but really most moms are very much alone, you know, thinking, why am I not feeling the way I'm supposed to feel? You know, why am I having trouble nursing? Why am I having trouble bonding? Why am I so overwhelmed? Why can't I handle it? And really feeling that they're personal failures.
Do you think it's any harder for women who are today entering motherhood than it was for their mothers?
There are many ways in which it's easier. You know, to the extent that we have choices, if we're really lucky, that women didn't have 30 years ago, that's a result of all the benefits of the women's movement. But there is one way in which it is harder, and that has to do with those of us who believed, as daughters of the women's movement, that we could take our relatively balanced relationships and keep them relatively balanced after the birth of a child. And the crashing shock and disappointment and resentment that is engendered when these women discover that, in fact, before the birth of the baby, you know, he cooked, she cleaned, she cooked, he cleaned. They both made, you know, roughly the same amount of money. They both were roughly, you know, the same amount of freedom. Suddenly the baby comes and it's 1946 at home. You know, it's like suddenly you're in a traditional relationship and this is not the script you wrote for your life. And realizing how few choices we have to really remake family life in a more equal way. You know, most women and men would like to have some real balance at home with their kids part of the time and working productively part of the time. That's a natural way for family life to proceed. But because of the kind of political pressures that I get into in the Motherhood Manifesto at the end of the book, we don't have the kinds of options that other countries very close by have offered women and men. In Canada, if you have a new baby, you get to stay home for a year on 80% of your salary, and your partner or husband, you know, the father of the baby does too. And that's a much easier transition into a strong family life than the shocking, do I stay home full-time, lose status, lose recognition, lose, you know, even if you're working at a low-status job or a low-income job, lose human contact with other people, you know, or do I work full-time? My God, after 3 months at home on no pay, leaving my baby when I'm still, you know, when my breasts are still full of milk, when my hormones say, don't walk out the door when that tiny baby is clinging to me. These are terrible, brutal choices. And if America is the greatest country in the world, which it is and should be, and if we really mean what we say about mothers and children, we need to organize into a political lobby, as I'm proud to say I call on women to do, and I've actually started an organization with Ann Crittenden to do this, to force the hand of politicians so we get actual family-friendly policies, so we're not faced with these devastating choices.
Naomi Wolf's new political organization is the National Women's Health Network. She spoke with Ann Strangeamps about her new book, Misconceptions. Next, not quite ready to carry a living, kicking little life to term? Well, maybe you could handle a Norn. Meet cyber god Steve Grand, the father of artificial life, when we come back. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Five years ago, Steve Grand single-handedly wrote 250,000 lines of computer code and produced the world's most advanced form of artificial life in the form of a game. It's called Creatures, and if you play it, you'll meet the Norns, virtual pets with brains, genes, and hormonal systems that live and breed in real time on ordinary desktop computers. There are roughly a million of these Norns living in cyberspace right now. More than 400 websites track their behavior, and fans frequently email favorite Norns to each other. Well, what do they look like? In the words of their creator, they are
soppy, dewy-eyed, awfully cute and sickly creatures who I have learned to hate over the last 10 years.
When you come across a Norn for the first time, what's the first thing that impresses you?
It depends on whether you know how it's done or not. They're pretty simple creatures. They're not very bright. But the important thing to realize is that I didn't program the creatures into the computer. So then, although I'm their creator, I didn't tell them how to behave. All I did was program the rules for behaviour from very much simpler things like nerve cells and chemical reactions and the kinds of things that biology uses. And then there are large networks of these nerve cells and chemical reactions that combine together to make a thing that lives and breathes and thinks and learns for itself. So once you realise how it's done, then they get a little more shocking because they're creatures with minds of their own who live out their own lives, make their own decisions, and I have practically no control over them at all. In fact, they hate me, I think.
And, in fact, if you were to come back and see any one of these creatures now, you would have no way of predicting what that individual, Norn, would be like.
No, none at all. And over the last 5 years since the game came out, they've evolved and changed as a species as well, so I probably wouldn't even recognize most of them anymore.
What happens if two Norns get together? Is there a possibility of mating, of breeding?
Oh, certainly, yes. Everything from mating behavior and love chases and falling out and all the usual romantic things that we all go through to actual mating, where they swap genes and the combined genomes from the two parents become the recipe for designing the children.
Do they evolve in the same way that we think that that other creatures do?
In principle, they can, yes. In principle, survival of the fittest will enable them to exploit improvements in their genetics that have come about through mutations or from crossbreeding between two different genetic types. In practice, what you get is a kind of anti-evolution because the people who look after these things really like the weird ones. So instead of the perfect ones surviving, it's the ones that go and sit in a corner and burble who get put on the internet and sent out to other people to breed from. And so it's actually the weird ones that survive, rather like dogs, I guess.
Yeah, survival of the fittest doesn't really apply, although I suppose somewhere there must be someone who is running this and trying to create the ultimate Norn.
People do, and I'm amazed at both the patience and the skill that they apply to this. People run whole sessions where they breed to try to breed in a particular characteristic or breed out a characteristic. And people have named the mutant types and the mutant genes and all sorts of stuff. I was really impressed by the quality of the science people do.
Are they software or are they living creatures?
Well, you can ask the same question about us. You might think that we are atoms, but we're not really. We are the patterns and relationships between atoms, and what makes a living thing alive is those relationships rather than the stuff itself. So there's no reason in principle why these software creatures shouldn't be alive, because we're software too.
When we think about what life is, what someone, what makes someone alive, it's an interior life, the imagination, the soul. Most people, I think, would say that that's what distinguishes human beings from machines. Is it what you're trying to do to, I think at one point in your book you said you were trying to figure out how to build a soul?
Yes, I may have hyped it up a little, but yes, what you're talking about there is really consciousness rather than life, and it's perfectly possible to be alive and not conscious. Every time you go to sleep, that happens to you. And I think what we really prize about life is not so much life itself as consciousness. The word imagination is absolutely critical to the concept of consciousness. Unless you have this inner world, this virtual world inside your head, you aren't conscious.
Once you start using the word soul, it implies a kind of existence that we don't ordinarily associate with machines. How can you put a soul into a machine?
We don't normally associate it with machines because the machines we've made up until now are very, very stupid. But that doesn't mean anything in principle against machines. I can't see any alternative to the fact that I'm a machine. I'm also conscious. But in every respect, I'm a machine and I obey the laws of physics. So consciousness and machines can go together because I am one of each.
Making that jump makes it possible for you to begin to think about how you can help a machine to acquire a soul. Is that the right way to phrase it?
Yes. We have to learn to think about machines differently. We've only had machines for a few hundred years, and we haven't got very good at making them yet. And to some extent, everything we've done has been to try to give machines no soul, to make them reliable, predictable, unsurprising, and to do exactly what they're told, which is exactly the opposite of a living thing. Living things are unpredictable and do what they want. So all of our science has been aimed towards making machines that were like clockwork. But that's just one aspect of machines, and machines can be very much richer and more complex than the ones we've made up until now. So just calling human beings machines, I don't think denigrates human beings at all. It just gives machines something to live up to.
Can you tell us something about the invention of the Norns? What was going through your mind when you began to work on them?
Blind panic, mostly. This started out as a 9-month project, and it came in a little bit late, about 4.5 years late. But when I started thinking about the problem, all I was actually intending to do was to create computer pets for people to play with. I thought it would be cute and fun. But I very quickly realised some things that sent me down a slippery slope. I realised that people wouldn't find these creatures fun unless they were engaging, and they wouldn't engage with them unless they really believed in them. And it's extremely hard to fool people into thinking that something is alive.
When you were working on this, you must have had various creatures that preceded the Norn, but you weren't fooled? Is that what you're saying, when they showed up on screen?
Well, I know everything there is to know about these creatures. Well, at least I did before I let go of them and they evolved. But I was still surprised. Quite often I was surprised. The first time I saw two of them playing ball with each other, I nearly fell off my chair because I knew that I hadn't programmed them to do that. And there they were batting a ball between each other. After a bit of analysis, I realised that it was no better than a couple of three-year-olds playing together. It was what you call parallel play, where they were both getting some benefit from playing in the same space with the same object, but they weren't actually playing with each other in the way that older children would. Wow. But it still surprised me.
You know, the one thing we really haven't talked about is the moral implication of creating artificial life. It's a kind of playing God, isn't it?
I guess so. I'm an atheist, but yes, it's playing at being a creator, certainly. But then we create life without much thought quite frequently. Quite often people decide to have children saying to each other, well, that would be nice, wouldn't it? And lo and behold, they have children. And we breed cows and then we shoot them and eat them. We tend to have a fairly cavalier attitude to life.
Do you worry about your Norns? Certainly not everyone who raises them is the kind of caregiver that you would approve of.
No, that's true. There's one particular person who styles himself anti-Norn and runs a website entirely devoted to torturing my little creatures. And I feel marginally sorry for the Norns. From my point of view, I treat them much as I would treat ants. I'm happy to exterminate ants in large numbers when they irritate me and spoil my garden. So I'm not too bothered about the Norns either. But the good thing is that when people start being cruel to them, it raises the question of what it means to be cruel. Are they alive? Do they have rights and responsibilities? Do we have responsibilities towards them? Can you be cruel to software?
You're suggesting, actually, we need to have this discussion before any more highly developed artificial intelligence begins to be made.
I think we should have had this discussion before any highly intelligent and advanced natural life forms were made. We don't really have a very good moral stance yet. We don't know what life is. We don't know when it starts and when it stops and how we should treat it. Our moral skills are not very good. And we need to think about these issues, not because of artificial life, but because of natural life and how our power over natural life has increased. And now we have to face problems with abortion and prolonging people's lives and cloning and all these other issues. And to a large extent, I think artificial life just throws all these issues into sharp focus. It gives us a second example of life to compare with and experiment with and think about these problems with.
Steve Grand is the co-founder of CyberLife Technology and the creator of the game Creatures. His book on artificial life is called Creation, Life and How to Make It. He's currently at work on an artificial orangutan named Lucy. You know, I don't mean to sound blasé, but it's getting kind of hard to keep track of all the artificial life forms out there. The computer guys are programming software and building neural networks. The engineers are making robots. The biologists have cloned sheep and cows and dogs. And now, to the best of our knowledge, has discovered that a certain scientist by the name of Viktor Raskolnikov has cloned several human beings.
Isn't it great? Aren't we a pair? I am no longer alone with you over there. Send in the clone.
Okay, come on in, clone. Single file, please.
With two of us working.
Working.
We're multiplying faster.
Faster.
We've cloned ourselves so many times.
Over.
We've lost track of who's the master. But we'd be surprised. If it's the one with five eyes.
Hey there, five eyes.
We have cloned she.
Ma.
And a pig's tush.
Boy.
But one thing is sure. We won't clone George Bush.
Either one of them. No way.
Because that would be wrong. Yes, it would bring
shame.
We may be mad. But we're not insane.
We're sane.
Millions of us. Without any wounds.
No wounds. No wounds whatsoever.
Making a fortune with our new Franken legumes.
Gumes.
There's only one problem.
Problem?
It's such a long wait to use the bathroom.
Hey, are you almost finished in there? I've really gotta go. Hurry up.
Dr. Viktor Raskolnikov and the Clonettes were discovered by our special correspondent, Doug Gordon.
Your children are not your children. They are the sons and the daughters of life's longing for itself. They come through you, but they are not from you. And though they are with you, they belong not to you. You can give them your love, but not your thoughts. For they have their own thoughts. They have their own thoughts. You can house their bodies, but not their souls. For their souls dwell in a place of tomorrow, which you cannot visit, not even in your dreams. You can strive to be like them, but you cannot make them just like you. Strive to be like them, but you cannot make them just like you. Your children are not your children. They are the sons and the daughters of life's longing for itself. They come through you, but they are not from you. And though they are with you, they belong not to you. You can give them your love, but not your thoughts. For they have their own thoughts. They have their own thoughts. You can house their bodies, but not their souls. For their souls dwell in a place of tomorrow, which you cannot visit, not even in your dreams. You can strive to be like them, but you cannot make them just like you. Strive to be like them, but you cannot make them just like you.
Sweet Honey in the Rock, on Children. Hey, remember learning the facts of life back in junior high? If you were lucky, you got to see that Disney film strip with an animated egg and sperm. But it turns out the real science of conception is even weirder and more wonderful. The Science of Pregnancy, when we come back. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Kids think it's gross. Parents blush to speak of it. But let's face it, everybody gets conceived the same way. Making Babies is the title of anatomist David Bainbridge's new book, but he's got more than an academic interest in the subject. When his first child, Eleanor, recently came screaming into the world, Bainbridge fell in love with the science of pregnancy. He told Steve Paulson the road to birth is fraught with mystery. To begin with, why does the mother's body accept this tiny visitor?
It really seems to be part of this general takeover that the baby does of the mother's system. But one of the things that people realize almost as soon as people started to work on organ transplantation and tissue grafting was they realized that in some ways, potentially, the baby may behave in some sort of strange way as a tissue graft, because obviously it gets half of its genes from its father, so half of the things it has on its surface maybe from the father, and yet the mother doesn't appear to recognize it as foreign. There's probably lots of different tricks and ways that it actually manages to do that, but one of the most remarkable is that there does seem to be a shift in the mother's immune system during pregnancy. Obviously, she's not completely immunosuppressed like somebody is who's being treated after an organ transplant, because obviously that would be dangerous for her and the baby, but there do seem to be very real changes in the way that her immune system works. So the baby really does seem to take over in a very aggressive way.
Do the egg and the sperm play more or less equal roles in the shaping of the baby?
In many ways, I like to think of this as the actual difference between males and females, is that one thing that's very noticeable about eggs and sperm is obviously sperm are very, very small. They're just about the smallest cell in the whole body, and many of the features of the way they're put together are really designed to make them as small as possible. Whereas if you compare them with an egg, the egg is certainly one of the biggest cells in the body. Relative to most cells, it's absolutely huge. So what you have when a sperm enters an egg is you have a very unequal combination of material. Basically, all the sperm does is provide nearly half the genes for the embryo, whereas the mother provides just over half the genes for the embryo. But more importantly than that, the egg is absolutely packed full of machinery to really guide the embryo's first few days of development. And certainly for the first few days of development, the development of a baby is very much controlled by things that have been put in the egg specifically for that purpose by the mother. And it's not really until those few days are up that the baby's own genes actually start to kick in and control its own destiny. So the sperm is very, although you always think of it as the active partner, actively in a very sort of machismo sort of way swimming towards the egg, once it's actually got in the egg, the roles are very much reversed. The sperm is very much passive and it's very much at the whim of the egg.
Does it matter very much which of the father's sperm manages to get into the egg? If a different sperm gets there first, will a very different baby result?
Yes, very much so. What happens when men make sperm and women make eggs, they basically discard half of their genes. This is part of the Faustian pact that they have to enter into when they decide to breed by sexual reproduction. They have to throw away half their genes, so only half of their genes are packaged into each sperm. And so obviously each sperm gets a different 50% of the genes. And so which sperm enters the egg very much affects the outcome for the baby.
And I suppose this may explain why there are so many sperms that men produce. Maybe there's something of the survival of the fittest.
To be honest, nobody really knows why men produce quite so many sperm. There's an inordinate number. It's probably in one ejaculation, a man may produce as many sperm as approximately as there are people in the United States. And nobody really knows why it has to be quite that many and why they have to be quite so small. You might almost argue that just a few very big sperm that can swim particularly fast might be more efficient, certainly in a case where, if you imagine women are actually mating with more than one man, you might imagine there was actually going to be competition between sperm from different males. And yet there doesn't seem to be much of a trend to have big, faster swimming sperm. So to answer the question of why men produce so many sperm, I don't think anybody really knows.
Now, obviously, one thing that has to happen during those first weeks of pregnancy is that the mother's body needs to stop menstruating. There needs to be some kind of a signal sent so that the embryo is not flushed out of her body. But isn't this actually rather rare in the animal world?
Menstruation itself is a relatively uncommon phenomenon. You only really see it in humans and our very close relatives, the higher apes. It doesn't really happen to a very great extent in really any other group of mammals. Obviously, many people, so presumably many women, would like to know exactly why this is, because it does seem to be an unbelievably inconvenient thing to have happen. The only reason that we really have good reason for why women are thought to menstruate is that what they're actually shedding at the end of each cycle is they're shedding, obviously, the thickened lining of the uterus, the lining of the womb. And that lining would otherwise have been the sort of bed into which the embryo was destined to implant. The other thing that's very characteristic of humans and higher apes is that the embryo invades very, very aggressively into the uterine wall. And so it's been suggested that a very extra thick lining is needed to actually absorb the ferocity of its attack. And this may be why the lining in this small group of primates, which obviously includes us, is so thick that it actually can't be just simply reabsorbed every cycle. It actually has to be shed.
It's fascinating to hear you describe what happens at the cellular level. It's almost as if there's a military action going on here. You use words like attack and defend.
Well, it's an interesting one because when you first look at it, it does seem like a very sort of aggressive attack from the embryo. But obviously, it's in the interest of both the mother and the baby that the pregnancy is successful. And we assume that at some stage there must be a sort of balance struck, a sort of truce agreed between the mother and the baby in which they agree on how far the baby is allowed to go. One thing that has come out just in very recent years is that there seems to be a bit of a battle between the genes that the baby carries. Babies seem to be able, certainly before birth, they seem to be able to tell which of the genes they got from their father and which of the genes they got from their mother. And there now seems to be quite a lot of evidence that genes from the father are desperately trying to make the baby grow as quickly as possible, whereas some genes from the mother, equivalent genes, are actually switched off to try and make the baby just moderate its growth a bit. Because obviously the father wants a strong, healthy child, whereas the mother, although she does want a strong, healthy child, she also doesn't want her body to be wrecked by the sheer size of the child. And so there does seem to be, if not a battle between the baby and the mother, there certainly seems to be some sort of battle between the parents going on.
How long does it take for the fetus to start to look like a baby?
Quite a remarkable amount of its development is really finished by about day 50, really, so about 7 weeks after fertilization. Obviously, after 7 weeks, it's still very, very small, but lots of the actual folding and forming of arms and legs and various bits and pieces of the body really is finished by that time. It does seem to be that really whatever size an animal is going to be eventually, even if it's going to be something like a whale, it seems to be easier to do all the very intricate bits of knitting together the body when the embryo is still very small.
Now, part of the fascination with this whole subject of pregnancy is what we might call the freaks of nature. And you write about some fascinating cases. One is where a fetus actually has another fetus inside it.
This is quite an uncommon thing to happen. But one of the processes that goes on when a baby is forming at a very early age, at a very early stage of pregnancies, that a baby really starts off as a flat sort of plate, if you like, and then folds over into a tube, and that tube, the middle of the tube, is their gut, which will obviously eventually form their stomach and intestines. And what can happen is that if you have two embryos that are developing and one for some reason is much larger than the other, then accidentally the larger embryo can actually, in its folding process, actually entrap the smaller embryo within it. And that embryo, the embryo that's trapped within it, obviously can't grow normally, but it often grows into something which looks like a sort of a very tiny vestigial baby. And these things are often found, well, not often, but when they are found, they're usually found sitting inside the abdomen, often deriving their blood supply from one of their larger twins' organs, like usually part of the intestine. I think perhaps they've only really been discovered recently, because they're the sort of thing, they were just picked up by chance on X-ray, really. Perhaps before, the last few decades, they probably, lots of people may have gone through life with these things inside them and just never realized.
So this could be not only a young child, but actually an adult who's carrying around this tiny fetus in a way.
Yes, I think it can. I mean, very often, I think they are picked up during childhood when children complain of abdominal pain. A mass is found in their abdomen. And yet, when you find a mass in a child's abdomen, you always fear the worst. But then when it's investigated and X-rays are taken, you actually find that this thing has many of the sort of components of the skeleton of a tiny vestigial baby. And then at that point, these things, nowadays, obviously, they're surgically removed. But I think in the past, these people just sort of had to suffer the pain and lived into adulthood with these things.
Now, we've been talking mainly about what happens during a woman's pregnancy, but I suppose the final mystery in this whole story is the moment of birth and how the baby can adapt to an entirely different environment.
This is the time at which suddenly the great control freak, the human baby, suddenly finds that it's thrown out into an unfriendly world and it just has to cope. And really, it has a list of priorities of things that it has to deal with when it's born. The very first thing it has to do, obviously, is it suddenly has to start breathing, because if it doesn't do that, then obviously its outlook isn't very good. And there's a lot of preparation that goes on in the womb for this baby's actually practice breathing. But then it's suggested that what happens effectively is when they're born, first of all, the actual squashing process that they go through as they're being born actually squashes their lungs down. Then when they're born, they actually sort of recoil. There's a sort of elastic recoil that sucks air in. But probably much more important than that is there's obviously, when they hit the cold air, the cold actually makes them gasp. And once they've taken that first breath and opened up their lungs, then really it's a lot easier from then on. And one of the most famous examples of this was actually the Russian painter Marc Chagall, who, when he was born, everybody thought the baby was dead. But the wily old Russian midwife dropped him into a bucket of ice water and that immediately made him start breathing. And this was sort of a recurring theme in his rather dreamlike paintings for the rest of his life.
David Bainbridge teaches comparative anatomy and physiology at the Royal Veterinary College in London. Steve Paulson spoke with him about his book Making Babies, The Science of Pregnancy.
Come to me, my melancholy baby. Cuddle up and don't be blue. All your fears are foolish fancies, maybe. Just remember how much I love you.
Maria Muldaur, singing Melancholy Baby. Now, parents, of course, get melancholy too, especially in those wee hours of the night. Long after your baby has finally learned to sleep and maybe even gone off to college, Parents still toss and turn some nights, worrying, regretting something about the way they raised that child. Well, according to Pulitzer Prize-winning author Jack Miles, maybe God has regrets, too. In his new book, Christ, A Crisis in the Life of God, Miles says if you read the Bible as literature, you'll see a guilty heavenly father repenting his heavy-handed ways with Adam and Eve. And that's why he sent us Jesus.
Jesus is God incarnate, according to the gospel story. He applies to himself the sacred name I Am, which is the name that God applied to himself when he spoke from the burning bush to Moses. But that God, and particularly on that occasion, was a warrior. When I Am spoke to Moses from the burning bush, he was announcing that things were going to become pretty terrible pretty soon for Pharaoh, and they did. The divine warrior, Yahweh, filled the land with vermin, poisoned the Nile River, slaughtered thousands of the youth of the country, all in the process of humbling and defeating Pharaoh and rescuing his chosen people, Israel, from bondage.
So you're saying the great paradox of the Gospels is why God chose this way to come back, to become incarnate, to become a man, and to become this very gentle man, unlike the God that we had seen in the Old Testament, this fierce warrior.
The question you have to ask yourself is, what else might he have been accomplishing by suffering this defeat? What was wrong that might be somehow set right in this way? And my reading, I'm sure it's not an orthodox Christian reading, but it seems to me to be a possible literary reading, and I claim in this book and its predecessor not to be a theologian, but just to be a literary critic. I'm not talking about the object of anyone's belief, just about the principal character in this classic of Western literature. Taking it that way, it's possible to see God himself as repenting.
Well, this is another shocking thing for you to say, that God did something wrong.
But, you know, doesn't it strike almost everyone, though we quickly learn to set the notion aside, but doesn't it strike almost everyone who reads the story of the sin of Adam and Eve that God's reaction is excessive?
To kick them out of the Garden of Eden.
Not just to expel them from the garden, but to take these creatures who were to have lived forever, who were not going to die, and to inflict capital punishment on them. He made them from dust, and then he sarcastically spat in their faces, "Dust thou art, and to dust thou shalt return." This is the reality of which finally he has to repent. And how does God give back the gift of immortality? He gives it back by inflicting on himself the capital punishment that he has inflicted on all of his human creatures, but then rising from the death that he has suffered. That alone wouldn't accomplish anything. That wouldn't correct the damage earlier done. But if he can unite them to him in some quasi-physical way or symbolic way, so that when he dies, he is with them in their death, but when he rises, they can be with him in his rising, then he can give back what he took away at the start, and he can repair what he set so badly amiss.
Let me follow up another assumption that you're making, and that's that Jesus is God. I thought Jesus was the Son of God.
The Father and I are one, he says. It's commonly asserted by historians that Jesus of Nazareth did not believe that he was God incarnate and, for that matter, may not have believed that he was the Messiah. Other historians disagree with those claims, and I'll leave them to work it out. It suffices that at certain points in one of the Gospels, Jesus makes statements there on the page that are unmistakable claims of divinity. Those claims then sort of radiate outward.
So to follow up on the story then of God becomes man and then dies and then rises again, what is accomplished? through the resurrection that couldn't be accomplished before.
You know, the second most shocking moment, I maintain, in the gospel story after the crucifixion itself and the cry, "My God, why hast thou forsaken me," from the cross, is the Last Supper. The Last Supper, if we think of Leonardo da Vinci's famous painting or other depictions of it, has a rather tranquil and beautiful air about it. There's something poignant but comforting about it. Well, though those qualities are not illusory, there's something happens in the course of the evening which is really very shocking. Jesus creates a quasi-cannibalistic ritual when he tells his followers to take bread and wine and eat it as if they were eating his body and blood. It is particularly the blood that shocks, because the rule of eating that was meticulously followed by the Jews was one that avoided at all costs the consumption of blood. This was the what you might call the anthropology of the time. It was observed that when people lost their blood, they died. Therefore, it was as if the blood had the life in it, and when the blood went out, the life went out. And life belonged to God, therefore blood belonged to God, and no one could eat it.
So Jesus was overturning all of this.
He was, and the shock is not just that he's giving them animal blood, but he's giving them human blood, his own blood, and he has claimed that he is God. So he's giving them God's blood to drink. It's an obscenity within an obscenity within an obscenity, but what is its meaning? I mean, if blood has life in it, what kind of life does God's blood have in it? It has eternal life in it, has immortality in it. So this is how he is giving back the gift of immortality that he took away in the Garden of Eden.
Jack Miles, talking with Steve Paulson about his new book, Christ, A Crisis in the Life of God. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to buy a cassette copy of this hour, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444 and ask for In the Beginning, number 1223B. You can find all of our shows online and listen to the most recent of them at www.wpr.org/book. Use the same address for questions or comments. That's www.wpr.org/book. And thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.